Glitterbugs, and welcome to the Classic English Literature Podcast. It's a ramble through the wide, beautiful meadow of British literature. Now, this is where rhyme gets its reason, and today's episode features Shakespeare's rhymiest play, I think it is, and one of his most popular, almost certainly his most popular comedy. That's right, we're talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, how much reason we get from this phantasmagoric nocturnal hallucination remains to be seen. But before we dream our dreamy dream, you should know that my email address is classicenglishliterature@gmail.com. Follow me and like all my posts on the InstaTwit Face Talk Tube. I haven't figured out how to work the X in instead of Twitter. It's coming. A 5-star rating on your podcatcher of choice would make me giddy with delight. Hee-hee! And please click the Support the Show button if you're willing and able to buy me a cup of coffee or something stronger, something malty and peaty. Thank you for your loyalty and support. So I'm going to start this episode with a confession. I'd never really liked A Midsummer Night's Dream. In fact, until maybe a month ago, I didn't even think I was going to do an episode on it. She Who Must Be Obeyed was quite surprised when she saw the film versions in our streaming queue. I didn't think you liked that play. Incidentally, it is one of She's favorites. You see, I thought I knew the play. Oh, it's the one with the fairies and the bumbling mechanicals and that scamp Robin Goodfellow. Of course I've read it several times, and I've seen performances and movies, but not for quite a while. And all I really recalled was a kind of gauzy, childish rom-com. You know, these apprehensions were reinforced by my recollection of Peter Weir's 1989 film Dead Poets Society. Maybe you remember this one. A lot of bookish people have fond memories of the Dead Poets. It's the movie in which there's the stern father who sees education only as an instrument for accumulating status and wealth, and he forbids his sensitive young son Neil from performing in A Midsummer Night's Dream at his boarding school. Now the boy defies his father at the urging of an inspirational English teacher. And he plays Puck triumphantly, and then ends his own life. It was all, for me, a bit too melodramatic. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a sucker for the big emotional rush of it, but too melodramatic. It's a feebly inspiring dilution urging us to follow our hearts or be true to ourselves and all the other anodyne bromides that decorate the walls of guidance counselors' offices. And instead of blaming the film, I blamed the play. But I'm here before you, a new man, with new eyes and a contrite soul. Since The Dream really is one of Billy the Bard's greatest hits, I realized that I could not dodge it here on the potty. So, with some reluctance, I returned to Elizabethan Athens and the magical forest and was struck with how distorted my memories of the play had been. Yes, there are fairies and bumbling mechanicals, but the play is so much richer, so much more complex and ambiguous than the mere twee rom-com come motivational speech that I had misremembered. Now, in case you too have faulty memories, or indeed have no familiarity at all with the play, here's a quick summary. Duke Theseus of Athens prepares to marry Hippolyta, queen of the Amazons, when he's interrupted by Aegeus, one of his courtiers, begging the duke to resolve a family dispute. Aegeus's daughter, Hermia, does not wish to marry Demetrius, the young man her father prefers, because she loves another young man, Lysander. The duke offers Hermia 3 options. 1. Obey her father. 2. Become a celibate nun. 3. Die. Striking upon their own option four, Lysandra and Hermia decide to run away and bewilderingly tell Helena, Hermia's friend, who bewilderingly is desperately in love with Demetrius. That night, Lysandra and Hermia flee Athens, but don't know where they're heading, and they get lost in the deep forest. Demetrius decides to follow the lovers into the woods. Now, why would he know to do that? Because Helena opened her mouth. And why? Because Hermia trusted her with the secret. There's a lesson there, kids. Of course, Helena follows Demetrius, expecting that he will abandon Hermia and fall in love with her instead, because of course he would, you know, after running after Hermia into the woods. Anyway, back in town, a group of working men, whom we call the Mechanicals, prepare a play for Duke Theseus on his wedding day. Nick Bottom, the weaver, is to play the tragic lover Pyramus, while Flute, the bellows mender, begrudgingly agrees to play Thisbe. Back in the forest, Oberon, the fairy king, has recently quarreled with his queen, Titania. She has acquired a magical Indian child and refuses to hand him over to Oberon, who wants the boy as a page. The reasonable solution here is, of course, to send your fairy servant, Puck, on a mission to gather a special flower whose nectar makes people fall in love with the next creature they see. It is the only way to deal with recalcitrant female disobedience. Then Oberon hears Demetrius and Helena arguing nearby. Demetrius abuses Helena, verbally and emotionally, with some room for the physical, should the director feel like it. Oberon orders Puck to give, quote, the Athenian a dose of the flower juice too, so Demetrius will fall in love with the first person that he sees. It is the only way to deal with recalcitrant male privilege. Now get this. Puck mistakes Lysandra for Demetrius. Can you believe it? Puts the nectar on his eyes while he sleeps, and when he is woken by Helena, falls immediately in love with her, Hermia becoming an unpleasant memory. Demetrius gets some juice too, eventually, and falls in love with Helena as well. Oh, such japes. Now, while all this is going on, the Mechanicals decide to rehearse their play in the woods in the middle of the night, an age-old and entirely sensible theatrical practice. Puck overhears them and, for a jolly jape, turns Bottom into an ass, a donkey. Bottom is then lured to Titania, who, while sleeping, yes, has been given the flower juice too. How much of that stuff is there? Now, when she wakes up, the beautiful fairy queen falls in love with the ugly ass. And they party. Meanwhile, Demetrius and Lysandra, still in thrall to love potion number 9, woo Helena. Hermia grumps about like the rejected pretty rich girl in a teen comedy. Oberon orders Puck to rectify all the chaos, as the lovers' bickering and chasing has exhausted them. Puck gets the lads lost in the woods with a bit of expert ventriloquism and puts an antidote on Lysander's eyes. Bottom, meanwhile, has been getting a spa treatment from Titania's fairies, then falls asleep beside the queen. Oberon restores Titania's sight. She wakes, understandably dismayed at the donkey in her bed. Having learned her lesson, she surrenders the little boy to Oberon for his page. Bottom gets de-assed and rejoins his friends in Athens during the dress rehearsal. Theseus and Hippolyta's prenuptial hunting party disturbs the slumber of the quarreling lovers. Lysander sees Hermia and once again falls in love with her. So, the four lovers become two happy couples, Lysandra and Hermia, Demetrius and Helena. Hey, let's have a triple wedding! Great idea! The mechanicals present Pyramus and Thisbe before the wedding guests, and as the three couples retire to bedtime frolics, Puck and the fairies return to bless the city and its people. The basic dynamic of drama, at least as classically conceived, is the restoration of order. After the hurly-burly of the plot's conflicts, the denouement reestablishes stability. Now, tragedies do this by killing off the main characters, and comedies do this by marrying off the main characters. I exaggerate, of course, for effect, but the principle is broadly sound. As Theseus himself says regarding Pyramus and Thisbe's, quote, tedious brief scene of, quote, tragical mirth, how shall we find the concord of this discord? Now note the opposites here, tedious and brief, tragic and mirthful, concord and discord. The play revels in crossing boundaries and transgressing categories. How are these things resolved? I think the play, for all its magic and enchantment, offers a pretty hard-headed response to this conundrum. Only the most casual of readers or observers can fail to notice the multiplying parallels Shakespeare establishes in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Theseus and Hippolyta have their complements in Oberon and Titania. Some productions actually emphasize this doubling by having the same actors play Theseus and Oberon, Hippolyta and Titania. Now we have the, well, it's not a love triangle really, is it? Perhaps the, maybe it's a love rhombus of Hermia, Helena, Lysander, and Demetrius. And then we got the parallels between Hippolyta, the captured Amazonian queen, and Titania's captured Indian boy. We've the gender power parallels, Theseus over Hippolyta, Oberon over Titania, Aegeus over Hermia. Even Peter Quince, in marshaling his little band of rustic players, is a rather crude version of Theseus and Oberon. And then, of course, we got that play within a play, the Pyramus and Thisbe dynamic. These parallelisms play out in a world of pitched opposites. So we've got parallels and opposites. There is Athens, right? The urban cosmopolitan metonym for reason and rationality, and that's set against the forest, the wild, irrational, impulsive, magical. On the more abstract level, certain elements of the play body forth the polarities of reason and imagination, consciousness and subconsciousness, cosmos and chaos, order and liberty, love and power. And in fact, Shakespeare employs various poetic meters to indicate these contrasts. Now, there's the stately blank verse of the Athenian court. In the forest, Puck speaks in a four-beat tetrameter line. It's more folksy and chant-like. It's kind of a nod to indigenous English folklore of the kind maybe the wife of Bath would recognize. And the mechanicals, of course, they speak in prose, their attempts at poesy only underscoring their uncouthness. Lack of couth. And of course, the great dichotomy of the play is that between waking and dreaming. We've mentioned dreams a few times in this podcast, going all the way back to episode 3 and the idea that literature is the dream of a culture or civilization. Episodes 10 and 11 looked at medieval dream vision poems like The Owl and the Nightingale and The Vision of Piers Plowman. In the Middle Ages, dreams were generally seen as something exterior to the person dreaming. They came from outside. They were a vision from God, perhaps, or maybe the devil. Drawing from classical writers like Artemidorus, early modern dream theorists began looking at a variety of origins and definitions for dreams. Some, like Mark DeVolson, a bit more traditional, thought that dreams foretold future events. So you remember Richard III and Richmond's dreams of the ghosts haunting them before the battle on Bosworth? That's the kind of thing DeVolson's talking about. Now, other scholars, like Richard Saunders, thought that dreams came from the dreamer, him or herself. Now, he believed dreams were affected by a person's humor, their health, and even by the time of the year. Now, a dream could be produced by something you ate. I'm thinking like remember Charles Dickens' Scrooge, when Marley's ghost is there and Scrooge says that Marley could be, quote, an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you or whatever you are. A fellow named Thomas Hill wrote the first book called The Interpretation of Dreams. I believe the case against Sigmund Freud is still outstanding. And he offers an encyclopedic catalog of symbolism and interpretation while admitting that most people dismissed such study as contemptible. Nonetheless, dreams produced a great deal of anxiety in the Elizabethan mind. Thomas Nash, better known as a playwright, and we may come across him in a future episode, he wrote a text called The Terrors of the Night, in which he argued that, quote, a dream is nothing else but a bubbling scum or froth of the fancy, which the day hath left undigested, or an after feast made of the fragments of idle imaginations. Now here, I think, is the source of the anxiety. What if dreams are interior? What if they do reveal impulses, desires, drives over which we have no control? That's the idea that Shakespeare is exploring in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Because governing all the parallels and all the doubles and all the opposites is a single dominant symbol, and that's the moon. Some form of the word moon appears 38 times in the dream. That's 3.5 times as many occurrences as in Love's Labour's Lost, which is the play with the second highest frequency of that word. It's mentioned 3 times in the play's first 10 lines as a metaphor for time's passage, especially the ending of one era and the beginning of another. Oberon and Theseus both refer to it as cold and virginal, being of a watery humor that is associated with femaleness, phlegm and black bile, dull and melancholy, according to humoral theory. That was the dominant approach to what we would now call psychology at the time, humoral theory. The Starveling, one of the mechanicals, plays the embodiment of moonshine in Pyramus and Thisbe, and he provides the occasion for several references to the moon's omnipotence. The hard-handed working men of Athens also give us a few mentions of the, quote, man in the moon, who at the time was the legendary patron deity of drunkards. We are also treated to an instance of the horned moon, perhaps a reference to illicit sexual activity and infidelity, fickleness, horns being the sign of the cuckold. Now, the moon is one of those archetypal symbols. Now, if that seems vaguely familiar, you're probably remembering our discussion in episode 5 on the Anglo-Saxon elegies, The Wanderer and the Seafarer, where I spoke of the ocean as an archetype of chaos. An archetype is a symbol that is recognized by many different cultures at many different times, transcultural and transhistorical. So, almost all cultures see the ocean or the water as a symbol for chaos or formlessness, but with the potential for order. So see the baptismal symbols, for instance, in Christianity. Most cultures see the directions east and west as cognate with birth and death, respectively, because of the sun's rising and setting. The forest, mentioned above, is an archetype for chaos too, but usually with an element of confusion or bewilderment. Think of all those fairy tales like Little Red Riding Hood or Hansel and Gretel, or places like Fangorn and Mirkwood in The Lord of the Rings, the Forbidden Forest in Harry Potter, or the Haunted Forest in The Wizard of Oz. Anyway, that's archetypes, and the moon is a big one. The most noteworthy characteristic of the moon in these terms is its changeability, its mutability. The moon waxes and wanes. It changes shape. It moves closer to us and further away. It brightens and darkens. It is inconstant. Now, couple that with the fact that the moon does not generate its own light, but rather reflects that of the sun, and we get the feminization of the moon, such as the Greek goddess Selene, or the Roman Diana, the Mesopotamian Nana, the Egyptian Khonsu, and the Hindu Chandra. Even in the Christian tradition, Mary is associated with the moon. Now, certainly we can see a somewhat misogynistic slant to such associations of inconstancy and dependency. But the moon has also powerful associations with fertility, gestation, renewal, especially as the female menstrual cycle loosely follows a lunar schedule, and the waxing moon approximates the pregnant belly. We should also note the moon's effect on the ebb and flow of ocean tides, right? So, there are also, of course, some less pleasant associations. The inconstancy mentioned a second ago also connotes a wildness, an irrationality, a madness, you know, hence our terms lunacy and lunatic. And we all know what happens to the lycanthrope in the full moon, the man who shapeshifts into a wolf. So the moon is very bound up in ideas of carnality, the cycle of creation and destruction, mutability, and the divine feminine. Now, how does all this come to bear on A Midsummer Night's Dream? Like, why is Shakespeare so insistent on emphasizing the moon's presence in the play? Okay, yes, one reason is simply a matter of setting. Shakespeare's theater had minimal apparatus for scenery, and since plays were performed during the day, one had to emphasize in the play's language the time of the play's action. Keep saying moon, and eventually even the groundlings will get that it's nighttime. But we'd only need that once per scene, maybe twice, right, to establish setting. What I think is interesting here is that Shakespeare uses the femininity and the changeability of the moon as a way of paradoxically restoring the order, which has been, you know, traditionally masculinized, restoring the order so necessary to the comedic structure, only to imply its disruption again. So let's look at a speech by Titania in the second act. She's been arguing with Oberon, accusing him of loving Hippolyta, and he claps back by saying, she loves Theseus. And then they bicker over the custody of the Indian boy, and before storming off, Titania offers this, quote, therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air that rheumatic diseases do abound, and through this distemperature we see the seasons alter. Hoary-headed frosts far in the fresh lap of the crimson rose, and on old Hyam's thin and icy crown an odorous chaplet of sweet summer buds is, as in mockery, set. The spring, the summer, the childing autumn, angry winter, change their wonted liveries, and the mazed world, by their increase, now knows not which is which. And this same progeny of evils comes from our debate, from our dissension. We are their parents and original. Titania posits that their arguing is the cause of all the chaos observable in the natural and civil worlds. Her notion that chaotic change comes from our debate, from our dissension, paradoxically points to a symmetry, right? A great chain of being, to use Aristotle's term. The idea that one thing is affected by another thing, that there is an order, and one thing out of place can affect the entire order. It's like a Jenga puzzle or butterfly effect, if you will. Now, interestingly, she also notes that they are the parents, the originals of all. This spiritual, magical, irrational realm is primordial. Now, compared to that, the conventions of human civilization seem trivial, even feeble. Now, I mentioned at the top of the show that the play has a bit of a dark edge that many often overlook. The play opens with two examples of sexual tyranny and cruelty. Right? Theseus has captured Hippolyta and will now marry her, though he laments, quote, "How slow this old moon wanes." That is, he's rather impatient, shall we say. She replies that the moon, like to a silver bow new bent in heaven, shall behold the night of our solemnities. I suppose she could be referring to something romantic like Cupid's bow. But the fact that she's an Amazon queen, a race of women known for their skill at archery, seems to moderate any enthusiasm one may be tempted to impute to her. But it is ambiguous, and I suppose she could be overwhelmed by Theseus's power and charm, like Xenocrate was with Tamburlaine. Shakespeare's audience would have seen her as a dense character illusion, not only a warrior queen, but one of a society that abjures males. And in the ancient myths, she is daughter of Ares, the god of war, and she features in the labors of Hercules. In Plutarch's Lives, a prime source for Shakespeare, Hippolyta brokers the peace with Theseus and offers marriage to seal the treaty, so it's she who restores and ensures order. Shakespeare's portrayal of her here calls up powerful associations and then ambiguously thwarts them. Now, Theseus then tells her, or actually tells us, really, because she already knows this, right? Quote, "Hippolyta, I wooed thee with my sword and won thy love, doing thee injuries." Now, to this, Hippolyta gives no reply. In fact, she remains silent throughout the rest of the scene, in which their conversation is interrupted by Aegeus demanding that the Duke support his patriarchal right over Hermia. Remember that she wishes to marry Lysander, of whom Aegeus disapproves, charging the young man, quote, "Thou hast by moonlight at her window sung." He wants her to marry Demetrius, and he then declares to Theseus, quote, "I beg the ancient privilege of Athens, and she is mine, I may dispose of her, which shall be either to this gentleman or to her death, according to our law, immediately provided in that case." How this gets forgotten in the many descriptions of the play as a childlike romp eludes me. The language of possession is blunt, that his daughter is an object to be disposed of as his right. He would prefer her immediate death to her disobedience. Now, the Duke does offer the third option of forced chastity as a nun, but in a play swollen with references to sexuality, fertility, and carnality, this is nearly a living death, isn't it? Oh, and there's another instance of the doubling I mentioned earlier, yeah? There seems to be no concrete reason for Hermia or Aegeus to prefer either of the young suitors. When the Duke says that Demetrius is a worthy gentleman, all Hermia can muster in reply is, quote, "So is Lysander." So the Duke says, you know, if they're both worthy, why not choose the one that Daddy wants? Wouldn't that be easier? I guess not. But Lysander and Demetrius are ciphers, really. They're interchangeable. And the fact that Puck confuses the one for the other in the forest only drives the point home. Come to think of it, there's not much daylight between Helena and Hermia either, though Helena is a more pathetic character, I think, desperate for Demetrius, who only abuses her. You know, like Theseus, you know, he won her love with abuse. Though, Hermia does get the brunt of Lysander's racist and sexist invective when he's drugged, so I call it a draw. But the events in the Night Forest, to some extent, thwart the orderly procession of rights and privileges that the men of Athens presume to hold. The juice of a simple flower confounds the dull senses of men whose superficial passions may be easily stirred by equally superficial appearances. For instance, the adjective fair precedes a female character's name almost 24 times, and it always feels like a rather pale word for beauty in this context. Titania twice applies the word to Bottom the Weaver after he's been transformed into an ass, once describing his fair virtue and once his fair large ears. The play's resolution, with its restoration of order, seems a rather peculiar one. Right, everybody gets married, Theseus to Hippolyta, Lysander to Hermia, and Helena to Demetrius. The mechanicals put on their play for the celebrations to great regard. Titania gives up her Indian child to Oberon to advance marital bliss. But these are, of course, not unmixed results. Hippolyta is forever captive. Demetrius is forever under the love spell, and thus a captive in his own way. Hermia does get Lysander, but Titania capitulates to Oberon, so the Indian boy loses his liberty too. Now, as drama demands, order is restored, but like I said, it's a very precarious one, one that contains the seeds of its own disruption. The moon will continue to wax and wane. Which is all very contrary to our ideas of romantic comedy, which many people assert has its roots in Shakespeare's play. In rom-coms, all those like Meg Ryan and Sandra Bullock movies from the 90s they're kind of the epitome of the genre now, though their debt to like the films of Hepburn, Tracy, and Grant from the 1940s is certainly immeasurable. Anyway, in those kinds of stories, stability is, well, it's really stable. The world before the lovers meet, misunderstand, and quarrel, and reconcile, is very much like the world after all the confusion gets sorted out. As people, the lovers alter very little, if at all. The modern rom-com assumes that the human self is fixed, immutable. What the characters undergo is not growth or change or refinement. Rather, at best, they only realize who they always really were, what they always really wanted. They didn't change, only what they knew about themselves changed. But Shakespeare's play only provides the appearance of order, a smoothing over that resolves, in fact, very little. The characters are not stable. They are often the mere shadows that Puck, in his famous epilogue, calls them, subject to irrational powers and drives and whims and dreams. The putative rationality of Athens and maleness is revealed to be as erratic and groundless as a fairy dream, and no match for the elemental forces of chaos that surround it. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'm really glad you came, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.